you've just tuned in, this is a Scott Walker special ahead of the BBC Prom, which is happening on Tuesday night at the Royal Albert Hall in London. And now, it gives me very great pleasure to welcome to the Sunday service today, Mr. Scott Walker. Hello, Scott.
Jarvis.
Hi.
How are you?
Not too bad.
Good, man.
This programme will go out 2 days before the BBC Prom, which is featuring your music. So I thought I'd start there. I'm assuming you know that this prom is taking place.
I do, yeah. By now I do.
And I wonder, because having met you and worked with you in the past, I know that you're not really a person who likes to go back into the past that much.
Mm.
So how did you, what was your reaction when you first heard that this prom was going to take place?
Well, you know, it was quite a surprise because they simply phoned up and announced their intentions. And would it be all right, you know, and I don't have any objection to people singing my stuff or anything like that, you know, and I would just kind of think, wow, it's quite a surprise. It's quite an honor.
Yeah. And has it encouraged you to listen to any of those songs again?
No.
No?
No, I'm like, with that kind of thing, with any past recording, I'm like sort of Don Quixote being confronted by the Knight of Mirrors. Mm. You know, all I ever do is hear the faults. I never hear anything else. So I never listen.
I suppose that's why I thought about that, because I remember you telling me a story about someone from a record company coming and listening to a playback of one of your records and then congratulating you at the end.
Yeah.
And you saying something along the lines of, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it because I'm never going to listen to that ever again.
Yes, that's right. So I just leave it, you know. And because, I mean, it's such a big thing for me to do a record, you know, and I sort of kind of put just about everything into it, as we all do when we're serious about recordings. And so I've done it there, and it's as good as I'm going to hear it or get it, you know.
Mm. But if I may, I would like to try and talk to you a little bit about, because I should tell the listeners, the songs that have been featured are songs from your first solo records that you did at the end of the 60s, immediately after leaving the Walker Brothers.
Yes.
And working with a lot of the same people who'd worked on those records.
Yes.
Like the producer, John Franz.
John Franz, yeah.
And other arrangers that are there. I've been listening to these songs because I have been asked to sing some of them.
Yeah.
Which I'm slightly scared about.
No, no, no. Listen, I'll be very interested to hear it.
One thing that I wondered, a very basic thing really, was how you actually wrote those songs. I mean, do you remember? Because they've got an orchestral backing and stuff like that, so it's not immediately apparent, you know, did you write them on the guitar? Did you write them on the piano? Or?
I wrote them all on guitar in those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I didn't have a keyboard. And while I'm writing, I'm arranging them in my head anyway, which is what I mean, these days, that still exists. If I'm writing, now I have keyboards, so now I can arrange. I'll start a song, even with the bare bones, but I can't help it. In my head, I'm always thinking kind of as an arranger. So a lot of that stuff was done that way, too. So I'd be writing down ideas for the arrangements as well as getting the basic thing together.
Yeah. So then would you take the basic idea in it and work with one of the arrangers?
Yes. Yeah, I'd take in all of this stuff that I'd gathered and, you know, sort of present it to them, and then we'd work through it that way.
And I guess it was part of how those records came to be was the studio system that still kind of existed in those days, because you had access to an orchestra.
It was four tunes in a three-hour session.
Mm.
I mean, the Beatles changed all that when they did the Sgt. Pepper thing, but if you were John Franz was very much a studio company man, and Dems was the rules, you know, it's four tunes in a three-hour session, so we had to stick to that.
And could you go back to something if you hadn't finished it?
No. I mean, you could ask to I only remember doing it for a Walker Brothers session for The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore, because I knew it was going to be a big hit. And the fixer who fixed that session, and it didn't happen often, hired a really deaf guitar player who had to play the intro, you know, and it just wasn't happening. I think initially at that point, too, we didn't get a good drummer then. We usually used Ronnie Verrill, who was fantastic. But I demanded that we re-record that.
Mm.
And so we recorded it again with all the right guys.
But that's pretty amazing. So you had to get the whole finished thing done in a four-hour session.
Yeah.
We've got a clip of John Franz. Would you like to hear it?
To hear him talk?
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind. I've got to have him in years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The Walker Brothers, I believe, were formed in Hollywood and played in some venue there. I think the person who formed them was Gary Walker, who got them together. And he had previously been here on a visit to England with PJ Proby as his drummer, I believe. And he loved England, and he talked them into coming to England. And they were signed to our company in America, so naturally they became my responsibility here. And they suggested certain songs, mainly Scott Walker, because he was rather the leader of the group, and he had the most idea of what should be done, the best idea of what should be done. And we ran a session, the first session. Out of that came an enormous hit, Make It Easy on Yourself. They didn't want that issued at first. They wanted something else issued, but I insisted on that one. It fortunately became number one. Then when that was an enormous hit, someone came along with a song, an American song called My Ship Is Coming In. And that was another very big one for them. They had quite a lot of hits and made some very good albums. And eventually, regrettably in some ways, they split up and Scott pursued a solo career, and we had some fantastic albums from him.
So there wow, we were very, very close friends, you know. That's amazing to hear. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because he produced all the Walker Brother albums and then all of your solo.
He did. We brought in, I mean, he'd been producing Dusty over there too, you know, and he was the house producer. And we brought in the stuff from Los Angeles. We'd been working with Jack Nietzsche, who had done Spectre's records. So we brought in like the three guitar players, two piano players, you know, two basses, two drummers, all that stuff.
Had you been recording as the Walker Brothers then, or was this like, because I know that you worked as like a session player and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, no, we recorded one record with Jack Nietzsche before, but I got quite friendly with him in a short period of time. We were together, and he showed me everything that was going on there. You know, he was on all those sessions. So that's what we brought to the party.
So it's like almost you were importing that Phil Spector approach to recording.
That's exactly. We brought it all the way over here. And then, and of course, they had a wonderful echo chamber at Philips. It was one of those tiled rooms with a mic in it, with a speaker in front of it. But that's all they had, a Gold Star in the States, too. But it was perfect.
And so were you putting your vocals down at the same time as... Is that how a session would work in those days?
Sometimes.
You'd go through it, and then the vocal would be done at the same time?
Yeah, sometimes we'd do it, and if we got lucky, we'd keep it, which we did a lot of the time, surprisingly. And if we didn't, the session would finish, and we'd stay on afterwards and patch stuff, you know.
And I suppose I've got to ask you, maybe you've answered this question a lot before, but the idea of coming from Hollywood, nice, warm climate, to... You know, mid-60s Britain must have been a bit of a culture shock and also just an atmosphere shock, just basically
a shock. I was looking forward to it. I mean, I like I'd said in the past, I mean, I was in love with the European film and European movies and British films and everything else. So I wanted to get to Europe, you know, and I'd always felt a part of it. So I was happy running around in the fog in those days. We had really dense fog and stuff in those days. You know?
Yeah, so that was kind of exotic.
Yeah, it was great, yes.
On those albums, the solo albums that you did, you featured, there were your own compositions, there were other people's songs, but also you featured a lot of Jack Brel material.
Yes.
Can you remember how you discovered his music?
I was seeing a German bunny girl who was working in the Playboy Club. And whenever I'd go back home with her, we drank a lot of Pernod, I remember, but she would listen constantly to Jacques Brel and French records and translate it to me. The upshot of this was the synchronicity was unbelievable, because then I walked into, a few weeks later, Andrew Oldham's office just to chat, because we would do that and drink Black Russians. There's a lot of drinking in those days. You would drink Black Russians. And I was telling him about this amazing Brel record I heard, and he said, funny you should say that, because I've got this demo from a guy called Eric Blau in the States, and they're trying to, it was translations of Brel in English, and they're trying to place this thing. And it was very bare, you know, bare bones sort of demo. And the demo was of several of the songs. And I said, well, I'll have that, because I just left the Brothers, and I was looking for a way, you know, a new way to start. And it was something I was passionate about. It was just perfect. Landed in my lap.
A striking thing about them, and something that I really cottoned on to when I first heard them, is this combination of like a kind of kitchen sink reality in the stories and in the lyrics, set to quite a kind of widescreen orchestral backing. And that was something that I had not heard before.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether, because Brel deals with similar, you know, it's real stories.
That's
and there are strong narrative structures to his songs, whether that was a kind of inspiration for your songwriting.
Oh, of course. The difference, I would say, is that my stuff tends to be more probably in those days, it was sort of hyper-real.
Mm.
So it has that kind of edge to it. Also, when I recorded his songs, I was very young, but when I recorded his songs, I think it's because I'd been working on those big songs with the brothers. It has a more epic surrounding, mm. the arrangements, you know.
I know we talked about these songs a long time after you did them, but that's a constant throughout the albums. Like say, if you take a song like Montague Terrace in Blue from the first solo record, and then the last from that period till the band comes in is almost like a song suite dealing with people in a kind of apartment block.
Yes.
There's a through line there of you. Well, there's a lot of rented accommodation in those songs. And yes. I wonder where. I mean, is that just because of your circumstances at the time?
Being trapped in rooms. Yeah,
yeah.
In those days, you know. And of course, solitude. That's the lethal combination that produced that stuff.
Well, it's not lethal. I mean, it's. As I say, that was something that really was. That I took to heart when I first heard those songs.
Yeah.
Because I'd always had this kind of vague feeling that, you know, profound things were to be found in the everyday details of life.
Yes.
But that was the first time that I'd really heard someone nail it in songs.
The ordinary being extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I wondered whether, again, that maybe had something to do with you coming from the States, that this would, what is everyday to us, in a way, would be slightly exotic to you.
Maybe.
You know, you
I wasn't. I wasn't thinking. I don't know if I was thinking about it in that way, but perhaps, yeah. Mm.
Do you mind if I play another clip? But this clip features you speaking.
Okay. What year is this? Do you know?
I'm not quite sure. I think it's this one.
I find singing very difficult. First of all, not physically, but the idea of it in general has always been difficult for me. I don't like singers very much. Other singers. I mean, I don't. There's very few singers that I really like. More and more and more, I listen to instrumental music through my life, you know. It's just, there's just such a lot of ego going on and all this kind of stuff. And I've watched singers work with musicians, and I've been a musician. This is another reason I started as a musician. And I've had to back arrogant singers at certain stages of my life, you know. And I really got, and they start arrogant. I mean, even when they have no experience at all, they begin that way, and they give the musicians a hell of a hard time. So I'm more like, I have more of a musician's mentality than I do a singer's mentality. But I don't think, quite honestly, about attacking it as a singer or a musician particularly. I'm just trying to focus in on the words and bring them through.
Wisely spoken, I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to be offended being a lead singer myself.
No. I mean, and also, you know, it's not in every case. You know, no, I mean, I've seen you working with musicians and you're not brutal with them. You know, that's at least not that I know of.
No, the reason I kind of wanted to play that with you, because that might be something that maybe people aren't that aware of mm. your back. As you say, you identify more as a musician and that's your background. And I wondered if we could talk a bit about that, because that's something that I don't know that much about. But you, am I right in thinking that you kind of started out as a bass player?
More or less, yeah. I mean, and sort of did the rounds there for a few years. I'd done some singing earlier on as a boy, but it was terrible. So I didn't do it. And then they signed us to Capitol. We recorded at Capitol. When they signed us, I can't remember who we were with. Was it Capitol, that first record? I can't remember. Mm. But anyway, they signed John, and John was the lead singer in the band that I finally wound up playing with. And in this, we were resident in this club in Hollywood. But they wanted a ballad, you know, with a lower voice, and so they asked me, and that's when I started singing again, this song, Love Her, which we recorded.
Mm.
And that's when it all began again.
I heard that you played in a surf band.
Which I played is not... with it. Do you know the band The Safaris?
Yeah, I do.
I played in the road band of that. Mm. You know, I wasn't on the. We were in Wyoming or Arizona or someplace like that. And one of our cars, we had these old cars on the road. One of them was sort of on the verge of breaking down. And I said, well, I've got to do the James Dean role, you know, from Rebel Without a Cause, you know, the one where he's on the chickie run and he opens the door at the last minute and rolls out.
Yeah.
I've got to take it off this cliff here and do the James Dean role. Now, the cliff was about, I would say, two stories tall. It's not that big a drop.
Mm.
And the car was going about 5 or 10 miles an hour. It wasn't, you know, but I did it. I did the role. I got out and the car went over the cliff. And that's what happened on that tour. That's the last I did with Safaris. Yeah.
And a band called The Routers.
The Routers, yeah.
Did you ever record with them?
No. I did, they had a big record called Let's Go. These guys were session musicians or whatever, you know. They made these records and they were looking for touring bands. And so I was... with a couple of those.
Did you ever play these songs live? You know, I mean, they're going to be performed live at this prom on the 25th.
No, no, never.
And was that just because you would have had to have an orchestra to play them?
Yes. And, well, pretty, yeah, I didn't work a lot, actually, in those days, you know. Mm. I just did a lot of recording, or I do television shows. I do some of the Brel things live. I did some gigs where I do those things, but not my own songs.
Mm. I want to talk to you about your voice, actually.
Yeah.
Did you have, like, vocal training? Did you have lessons?
No, no. There was one stage when I'd been in with the brothers for, I don't know, probably into the second or third record, when I thought I'd better learn a little more about what's actually happening with the voice, you know. So I went to a guy, and he showed me a few things, and then I'd say, okay, I'll see you next week, and I'd turn up 6 months later, and you know what I mean? He was very patient, but it was a futile exercise, you know. So basically, I just listened to a lot of certain kinds of singers, and I'd work out stuff about breath control and how to connect a phrase if I needed to and stuff like that. It's very interesting to see what people are actually doing.
Mm. Well, I know that you're an admirer of Frank Sinatra's vocal technique.
Well, his technique, yeah.
Are there any other singers that you remember listening to in that way?
Well, who have great technique. There's not a lot of people who have it. Mel Torme has great technique, but it's a bit too mellow, you know, it's a bit too... But then you don't really need it. I mean, especially as things changed. I mean, when Dylan came in, that whole thing changed, you know, so people can do it. There are still things you can use. I mean, the thing where Sinatra was great was there were guys with better voices than Sinatra, but he had this way of putting together a sentence or a paragraph even sometimes with the breath control where the story unfolds better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more complete.
Have you any kind of inkling of why you decided to do the style of music that you did? Because it kind of went against the grain of what was happening at that time.
Yeah.
To do stuff that did use an orchestral backing, but in a different way. But it wasn't, you know, I guess everybody else was strumming acoustic guitars and stuff like this.
Yeah.
But you decided to go that other way. And have you got any kind of ideas about why you decided to do that?
Well, it's only because, as we said, you know, the things I was interested in, if you listen to the French records or any of those things, that's the way that was going. That's what attracted me. The other stuff didn't.
Mm. And were you listening to a lot of classical music?
A lot of it, yeah. But mostly jazz in those days. I was a big jazz addict. In the States, I was, when I'd finish as a musician at night, I'd go to a jazz club or I'd go to, you know, on the weekends. And when I came over here, I practically lived in Ronnie's. I saw everybody there, you know. So I was listening to a lot of all that.
And what was it that attracted you to jazz? The thing that people are making it up on the spur of the moment?
Yeah. And the sophistication of it, you know, it was just fantastic. I mean, I'd seen Miles several times, you know, and John Coltrane. I saw so many people, you know, amazing.
As you were writing songs, did you ever think of writing songs for other people at that time?
No.
No,
because mostly, especially in the brothers' days, the managers were getting me to write songs so I could get the royalties from the songs, you know, so B-sides, basically, and fillers for the albums. And so it kind of started like that. So any song of mine was considered sort of secondary to the main attraction, really. Mm. And it, as years have gone by, it's kind of changed. So
that's interesting. I mean, I can't remember. I was talking to someone about that, the fact that B-sides and things like that did used to give people somewhere to experiment
and
find things out, because it was like, well, we just need something to fill that space up.
And that was a lucky bit, because I could work with a big orchestra. Mm. You know, it was on hand. So that was very fortunate.
This prom is taking place on Tuesday, the 25th of July.
Yes.
I'm going to sing a couple of songs. Richard Hawley's also singing. John Grant and Suzanne... Forgotten a second.
Sunder.
That's it.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to pronounce that O with a line through it.
Yes, I think that's correct myself, anyway. Yep. So,
as I've been looking at the songs and trying to find a way, and that's an interesting process, because I think that they are very personal songs.
Mm.
And so to find a way into them is a... Yeah, it's an interesting thing to go through, because you don't want it to be like a karaoke version where you're just trying to sing it exactly the same as the way it's been sung before.
Yes.
But then you don't want to have people go, you know, what was that?
Yeah.
Because they don't recognise it.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you've got any tips for me there.
I think the arranger asked my manager the same kind of things, and I said, well, make it as new as you can, you know. Mm. That's the only thing I can say, because you're absolutely right. Otherwise, it goes into some kind of karaoke or strange thing like that. And so try to approach it in a new way. Mm. You know?
It's more about the kind of the lyrical concerns, I suppose.
Yeah. I can't help you there, unfortunately, because you have to find your own way into that, mm. you know. Because, I mean, I just did it the way I did it.
But do you remember how you approached, say, if you were singing other people's songs in those days? Because the first three solo albums are a mixture of original stuff and covers.
Yeah.
How did you go about it, if I may ask you that?
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's so long ago. I just don't know. I can't recall how I did it.
Maybe the answer is not to think about it.
Not to think about it, exactly. Yeah, don't overthink it.
Before this interview started, we were talking about, as I've been researching the songs, some of the lyrics online aren't strictly correct.
Exactly, because there's all kinds of versions you can find. But I found a couple of mistakes, because I mentioned in the song Boy Child, because I got a very good take of that, and that was done live, because of one word, I left it. There's a word, stays, which should have been strays.
Mm.
And there's another song, I think it's a song called Duchess, that I was scat singing a bit of that. So I would say, when you're coming across, what the actual line was, as you come across.
Mm.
It didn't happen often, but if I got a good take for the whole thing, I'd keep it.
Yeah.
You know.
Actually, you mentioned scat there. That's something that's on Scott 4, there's three songs that you end in a scat.
A scatting, yeah.
Yeah, which has always intrigued me.
Well, it's just, there was kind of a space there to do it, you know, and I thought, well, fill it up, you know, with my jazz thing coming out.
Is that you playing the bass? That's got a very good bass line, that track.
No, I can't remember who did it. No, I can't remember, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, yeah, but that's a great bass on that.
It would have been a very fine bass player anyway.
Mm. But we've got this, there's a line in there, so we've got, the crowds just gathered, their faces turned away, and they queue all day like dragons of disgust, which,
yeah.
That's a favourite phrase of mine, dragons of disgust, I'd like to see what they looked like.
Yeah.
But this is from the internet now, so then the next line, all the women whispering, wondering just what these young hotheads want of us, and then here it says, and Andre's V, he cries, but
Andre V.
Yeah.
Andre V.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
He sounds like a name.
Yeah,
is Andre V a person?
Voznesensky.
Yeah.
It's meant to be Andre Voznesensky. So he was a Russian poet at that time.
Right.
So, yeah, that's what that meant. Did you get that off the internet?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a nice word anyway.
Entre V.
Entre V.
Maybe that's what we're doing at the moment.
Maybe that's what I should have sung, you know? Yeah.
No, so tell me a bit about Andre V. I've not heard
of it. Oh, no, this time, by the time the fourth album had rolled around, I was interested in all things Russian. In fact, I went on my own to Russia.
Yeah.
And there's a fabulous story, which I won't go into there now, because it goes on for about an hour. Every time I tell it to people, they go, oh, my God. So I'll just leave that hanging. But, all things Russian. So I was reading, like, because Solzhenitsyn had been published then. So I was reading a lot of that. I was reading a lot of Evtushenko, listening to a lot of Russian music, Shostakovich, etc., you know, although that's not reflected in the record. And a lot of Russian history, and that's just part of that song. You know?
Mm. You've intrigued me now with your Russian
story.
Yeah,
but, yeah. I'll tell you some other time we're off air, because
well, it's incriminating.
Yeah.
The poem Foggy Street by Andre Voznesensky, by now you know I'm no good at pronouncing things, as read by the person who translated it from Russian into English, Richard Wilbur. That's taken from an album that we got from the BBC archives, Anti-Worlds, the poetry of Andre Voznesensky, the Andre V, mentioned in the lyrics to The Old Man's Back Again. In fact, this collection of poems, Anti-Worlds, also gets mentioned in the lyrics of that as well. But I also wanted to go on and talk to Scott about other influences on his work. The Seventh Seal basically kind of tells the story of the Bergman film. Is Bergman like an important filmmaker for you?
Yeah. Before I came here, I'd seen lots of Bergman films.
Mm.
I ran across it accidentally. I used to go to a film theater on Hollywood Boulevard. I can't remember the name again. But they used to show late night movies, you know, like stacks of them, you know, and you'd go and you sit there practically all night. And late night, The Virgin Spring came on, his film The Virgin Spring, and it was dubbed. And I'd never seen anything like it, you know, and I was about 16 or something like that. So from then on, it kind of took off. I started going to the art houses and watching his films.
Mm. What was it that kind of grabbed you about that?
Well, I like the photography, first of all. It's fantastic. I mean, he claims that he was copying Kurosawa.
Mm.
And you can see a lot of that there, you know. And so I was fascinated by that. And just the time that everyone was allowed to do things, you know, in European films. You know, even in Hollywood in those days, things were being cut pretty much, you know. The atmosphere of the time, I like that.
You're listening to a Scott Walker special edition of The Sunday Service today. The next thing I talked to Scott about was the arranger of that track. You talked about Wally Stott, one of the arrangers on your records.
Yes.
And being able to work with these people, I guess, who could tell you how to get sounds. And I wonder how that process worked.
Yes, I was bringing all kinds of things in as examples for him, you know, I remember bringing in for Boy Child the gong, 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 the thing at the beginning, that cymbalum thing that goes on. I'd had that all written out, and I brought it in, and I know I'd been listening to Bartok, but of course Bartok took that from folk music, so he'd taken that from, you know, from another source. So that's how that particular song had started.
But would you sometimes go to them with an idea of a mood or something, and they would tell you how you could achieve that with...
Yes.
With the instruments, you know, within the orchestra.
Yeah, of course. Or they simply do it, you know, and I'd turn up and then I'd see how it was done.
Mm.
Like I said, there were countless examples of, I mean, actually, Wally and I just, we didn't get on that well, really.
Mm.
You know, I got on a lot better with Peter Knight, and I think Wally considered me to be a bit of an upstart, you know, because I was always pushing him, you know. I mean, I was quite demanding. And he was used to coming in and doing sort of Harry Secombe records. You know, John would say, take this away, and he'd go away, do the arrangement, and come in.
Yeah.
He was not used to having people interfere with the process.
I wonder whether in some ways that was nice for him, that you were actually taking an interest in it.
Well, it was, but I think the conflict worked in our favor, because to my knowledge, he'd never done better arrangements than he did for me, you know. So I think the conflict kind of helped. But there were a lot of difficult things going on in his life anyway, you know. He eventually would transition and things like that were happening, so perhaps I wasn't as understanding as I might have been, you know. But anyway, we were getting results, and it's funny because when we did the first record with the Brel stuff, he was very prudish about the language, you know. He was very, I really don't know if I want my name on the record because it's, you know, he's saying this, you know. Yeah. So finally he decided, well, I'll have my name on. So we put the album out. The album went to number one, of course, and the records we did after that, he was glad to have his name.
When David Bowie passed away, we got some clips together, and there was this clip of you sending a greeting to him on his 50th birthday.
Yes.
It was a very interesting and quite a moving clip, really, because this message that you'd obviously recorded on a cassette or whatever was played to him.
Yes.
And he kind of went silent for about a minute after.
Oh.
And was obviously very touched by that message.
Oh.
It just made me wonder of whether you... Did you meet him? Did you know him in any way?
Well, we spoke several times on the phone about various things. And he wanted, at one stage, to do an interview with me. This was, 10 years ago, maybe? Something like that. And I didn't do it, and I can't remember why I didn't do it. But, yes, every time I spoke to him, he was just very nice to me, and the thing about it, he always was on my side. I mean, he would recommend people to listen to my records. You know, he was really generous when it came to me, you know, and always interested in what I was doing. And every time I spoke to him on the phone, he'd say, here I am overlooking the park. It's sort of snowing, and it looks lovely. What he, you know, he'd describe where he was. And I thought, I'm sitting in the flat here, and, you know, wherever I was, you know. But I always remember that about him, you know. He was funny, but it was such a shock to all of us.
But he was a big champion of your music.
He was.
And he covered Night Flights on the Black Tie White Noise album.
He did, yeah. No, I know, he was, when it came to me, like I said, he was more than generous.
I guess what you were doing in the 60s, these songs that are going to be revisited at the proms.
Mm.
I mean, I suppose the first time that they were reevaluated must have been when Julian Cope put that Fire Escape in the Sky compilation together.
Yeah.
Which was like the early 80s, I believe.
Yes.
Because as you say, on the albums themselves, your original compositions were kind of dotted in with other songs as well. But that was the first time he'd kind of taken that and presented them as a whole thing.
That's right, yes.
And so that was already kind of 15 years after the records had been made.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, it kind of was out of step with what was going on. I mean, we've kind of discussed that. Dylan was around and stuff like that. It certainly wasn't what a lot of other people were doing. And I don't think many people have done it since.
The thing was is that, look, folk music's perfectly fine with me, but I was never that interested in it. I mean, that was his kind of starting point. And also, it was too limited in its musical content for me. You know, it was just not challenging enough in any kind of way. So that ruled that going that way out for me. And, of course, a lot of the music was following that in those days. So a lot of the electronic music was just really hyper-folk music, you know, if you take it apart.
Mm.
And like I said, I'd been listening to a lot of jazz and stuff, so the only possible direction for me to take would have been either to kind of pursue that, which to me, the scat side of it was kind of running out of steam anyway, all that sort of thing. But I didn't have the imagination for that. I had more of a visual or literary imagination, so I couldn't take that in with me. So that's why I'd gone the way I'd gone. And you were right, maybe I was at a younger age listening to myself then too.
Yeah, I think that's why people appreciate what you do, because you've continued to do that and you're still pursuing that.
Yeah.
Not that many people are still doing that.
I'm still beating my head against the brick wall.
No, but it's not that. No, you could look at it in that way, yeah. Or you could say that, but you're still on a quest. You're still looking for something and trying to express something.
Yes, I'm still listening.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's why people appreciate what you do.
Great. Pretty much my sound is kind of my sound now. It's where I've arrived at my history. You change, you go with your history through your life, and your history, personal history, changes. So you stretch out, you listen to yourself carefully, and you stretch out to that. You reach out to that, and you have to listen to yourself and nail that one. That's the difficult bit. So
you kind of see what you're capable of at that particular time.
No, it isn't your vocal or physical capability. I mean, although that could enter it, it's your consciousness calling you to head in a certain possibility and reject others. So you're editing out other things. So it's a work of personal history, your life, you know, an individual's life. So that's what I listen to, you know, all the time, and just kind of keep going in that direction.
And it seems to me that you've probably always done that.
Perhaps, you know. I probably wasn't so much realizing it when I was younger, you know. It kind of started clicking with me around, I did an album called Climate of Hunter, which is kind of a lost record, but it sort of started clicking around there, you know, kind of fighting my way back through it.
Can I play you a clip of you talking around the period of Climate of Hunter? It says something about the process of making that record.
All right, yeah.
I had a lot of, as everyone does, personal problems come upon me after that happened, and I had, as I was always thinking towards this album, the idea was to try to let it come to me rather than have to push it. So I was waiting, and this process of waiting is very exhausting and nerve-wracking. It's a different kind of thing. And I thought, but this is the way it has to be done. And I made several attempts in very noisy flats, and I kept losing these flats too. And could not get there. And, you know, as time goes by, you get further and further into the hole, and you just do not. Everything seems to get further away from you. I quit about three times, you know, for four-month periods, and that took up some of the time. And last year, one of my publishers, who publishers normally don't pay you, but this one paid me. So I decided I was working towards this total silence. I figured I need this total thing. And I rent myself a workman's cottage. I saw it in the back of the newspaper, just outside of Tunbridge Wells. And I took all my bits and pieces and my Telecaster, and I went down into there. And it was way away from me. I took a wheelbarrow, literally, every day up and down this hill, you know. And I lived alone there for 2 months and put it all together there.
So that's the story of... I just like the image of
you.
I almost
sound like I know what I'm talking about.
I like the image of you walking around with a wheelbarrow with a guitar in it. Is that... Yeah. That's the way it happened.
Well, yeah. As I recall it, there was in the back field, there were a load of cows. You know, so all these cows, and I'd walk out, and I'd say hello to the cows, and then they'd step on my toes and stuff like that, you know. There's mud all over the place. But that's about all I remember of that. God, that's incredible. Well, you can see there's a hint there, what I was just talking about now.
Yeah.
There's a hint there of that.
Yeah, of you. Well, you said that maybe that's when you started to work in the way that you've worked since.
Yes, yeah. Well, very interesting. Yeah.
Still got the wheelbarrow?
No, I didn't say. I got a bike now that I keep crashing and, falling off of and whatever, but that's another story.
Scott, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
For coming in and talking to us.
Good luck with the prom. Well, I should look forward to hearing it because, like I said, I haven't heard those songs since the years I wrote them. Mm. And I'm just glad I don't have to hear myself sing. I can hear you guys instead.
Well, I know you've always had this thing about not wanting to look back at stuff you've done, but I think it's great that it acknowledges that those songs have stood the test of time.
Yes.
And I know that it's at the proms, and so they will be orchestrated properly and presented in a proper way.
Exactly.
So I think that's a really great thing, and I'm very honoured to be part of it. Slightly scared. Little bit less scared now that you've corrected some of the lyrical, discrepancies.
Right, and we'll send you the whatever changes.
Yeah, so that's going to help me a lot. Yeah.
Okay.
But, thank you very much for coming on.
Jarvis, thanks.
All right.
Yeah.